On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On this Thanksgiving Day, we gather together for a hymn of food. There is still plenty of turkey roasting today and a lot of tradition. But American cuisine is changing, too. In a food revolution toward the organic, the free-range, the mainstream gourmet. This hour on Point, we're looking beyond the mashed potatoes to the delicious story of America's food revolution. I'm joined from New York by David Camp, writer and editor for Vanity Fair and GQ magazines, and author of the new book, The United States of Arugula, How We Became a Gourmet Nation. Welcome, David. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Tom. Happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. And with me in the studio this hour is Cheryl Julian, food editor at the Boston Globe and co-author of The Way We Cook, Recipes from the New American Kitchen. Cheryl Julian, wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
So here we are, tapes rolling, and we're doing it all for Thanksgiving. And we can just imagine right out across the country in all those kitchens, counters full of celery to be chopped and cornbread to be crumbled and turkey maybe already in the oven. David Camp, you're writing about the United States of arugula. I don't know if this is the day of fast-forward evolution in American cuisine or if this is the day of tradition, really.
Well, it's a day of tradition. It also happens to be my favorite holiday because it is food-centric. But you can measure ways in which it's changed. Yes, on the one hand, we have the traditional turkey and the traditional pumpkin pie. But on the other hand, you see people caring more and more about going to, say, farmers markets to get these sides, the vegetables and things they're going to need, and going to farmers and sustainably raised turkeys, that sort of thing. You see that changing.
You know, it's a close call, but I think in the end it may be my favorite holiday as well, just because it's all about family and, as you say, David, food. Cheryl, what's on the agenda for your oven today, Thanksgiving Day?
Also my favorite holiday, by the way, and the reason is because I think all holidays are food-centric.
Right.
The reason this one's my favorite.
Even Arbor Day?
Well, hey, what the heck? Break out some grapes.
Yeah, there are no gifts.
Right,
and
there's
that's
no
so
other
nice.
Agenda. It's
yes,
just
the only thing people bring you is an offering for the table.
Yeah.
Because it has really become a potluck holiday. I think people are busy. They can't make the whole feast, and relatives share recipes.
You're both foodies. David Camp, let's stick with Thanksgiving for a second. On this holiday, what's traditional at your table, and what might be a little signal of the arugula nation you're writing about?
Well, I'll tell you something that's traditional yet not traditional. I only have one friend who's actually what you'd call a celebrity chef,
yeah,
as opposed to a chef I've interviewed in the past.
Yes.
And it happens to be Mario Batali,
oh,
who
yeah.
is well known for Molto Mario on the Food Network. And
larger than life.
Mm-hmm. Larger than life. But Mario is a wonderful guy, and he said to me a couple years ago, hey, why don't we prepare our Thanksgiving turkeys together? Mm. And it wasn't this radical departure where everyone at the table is like, ew, this has gone too far. What we did was we got some great upstate New York organic turkeys. We brined them in giant industrial-sized hardware store buckets and, you know, salt and sugar and celery seed for a couple of days. Then we deboned the turkeys so you could sort of roll them up. And we rolled them up not around your traditional Pepperidge Farm stuffing, but around a risotto stuffing with little chopped up bits of Italian sausage.
Wow.
And the great thing about that was it took less time to cook and it cooked more evenly without the too dry white meat and the too raw dark meat. And the thing is, it was just so wonderful because it was a twist on an old tradition, but it still tasted like Thanksgiving.
So you had something old and something new all rolled up together in that roll.
Literally rolled up, yes.
Cheryl Julian, I've already been sitting here munching on your rosemary biscuits with smoked turkey and cranberry relish. Delicious, but what about your table on this day? What old,
well,
what new?
I'm delighted to hear what David has for Thanksgiving because we also bone the turkey.
Every year, that's just the way you do
it. Yes, and I'm an old-fashioned girl. I really fought this tooth and nail. But we
no
flatten it.
No grand entrance for the tall turkey with the
No, there's no grand entrance because we serve it carved because mm-hmm. we're so worried that everyone's going to miss this great bird at the table. And we leave the wings intact and the drumsticks intact mm-hmm. and flatten it and roast it flattened. We also brine it for a day. And the years that we don't brine it, we buy a kosher turkey because that has been brined essentially.
What does brining do for it? Does it enhance the flavor? Does it bring a new flavor to it?
Well, I think it adds a bit of salt, which is what everyone wants.
And how deep into the turkey does the brining
deep.
Take that? Deep, after
yes,
a couple of
yes,
days.
Yes, really, the meat is really luscious.
Wow. I think the shorthand description might be it's almost more of a deli meat flavor than you know, just a generic turkey flavor.
Right, without the additives.
Yes, yeah. Oh, it sounds good. So you've got a flattened turkey with wings and drumsticks still going on.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm all set here. We've got the smell in our nostrils and the flavor of that ready to roll around our tongues. David Camp, take us in to some of the theme of the evolution of American cuisine that you're writing about in the United States of Arugula. What's the case you're making here? It's a very traditional day today, but all around that, you see a lot of change.
Yes, I do. And I think it's a remarkable change, and it's, to me, one of the most upbeat progressions culturally that we've been able to experience in America. I mean, I think it's all too common and, alas, all too valid to say movies just aren't as good as they used to be, you know, TV shows, rock music, ladies' millinery, what have you.
All right.
But food is something that I think is really better than it used to be. If I go back to my childhood, I'm a child more or less of the 1970s, it really was a case of eating store-bought Wonder Bread, iceberg lettuce, even romaine lettuce was considered exotic at the time. And to have the sheer choice and the improved quality of the produce in the produce sections of the supermarkets, and that's not even getting into all the gourmet, quote-unquote, artisanal stuff out there. I'm just writing, chronicling how this all changed, and more importantly, who were the people who affected this change? Because these are important people, important contributors to American life, in my opinion.
Well, we'll look at some of those people, but give us some examples, some specifics of the kind of then and now. When you describe this evolution beyond the iceberg lettuce, you know, what might have been the meal then and what you see now that's approaching mainstream? They've always had gourmands, but you know, what new sort of diversity and wonderments do you see that are really widely embraced?
Well, I remember when I was a kid, and let's talk about cheese. If you were going to put out a little bit of cheese before the dinner as a snack, the cheese and crackers, it might have been this, you know, industrially produced Wispride wine cheddar. You know, it's this processed cheddar
spread. And
that would
be the fancy day. Leave the Velveeta in the fridge for one day, please.
Yeah, I'm saying this is when you're putting it out for company,
trying
to impress the company. It was that, like, sort of wine-splotched, wine-stained, soft cheddar spread. And I loved it, actually. I mean,
rolled,
you know,
in nuts sometimes, as I recall.
Right, and to this day, there's almost a Proustian swell of memory that eating that stuff evokes. I'm not a snob about that. But that said, then suddenly brie came along, and then not only brie, but herbal brie, or brie with, you know, nuts in it or something. You know, so we've had this progression that, you know, people like Giorgio De Luca, who was the guy, one of the two men behind the store, Dean and De Luca, which is a New York market that became a small national chain of upmarket gourmet stores. He talks about how he introduced people to goat cheeses, to soft cheeses, to that there was a world beyond hard cheddars and hard Parmesan bricks, and that you can have, you know, umpteen varieties of cheese. And when you have that cheese and cracker plate you're putting out for company to nibble on before the food comes out, it's now varied. Some of it's great new American artisanal stuff. Some of it is imported stuff that you couldn't get imported 20, 30 years ago. And then there's things like goat cheese, which wasn't even commercially produced in the United States till 1979.
And
shows
that's
how recent it all is.
Yeah, and that's just the cheese. Cheryl Julian, a lot of old-fashioned eating, a lot of fully processed eating still going on in this country. But David Camp looks out and he sees, hey, not everything may be better, but on the whole, food has really stepped forward. Do you see it?
I think that what he says is quite true. It's extraordinary how great the quality is now, and that you can go to the farmers who are planting heirloom seeds and giving us apples, for instance, that taste like apples did when I was a girl. But I think there are a lot of people in between who can't take the time, don't know about these places, and really must go to the supermarket. And if the supermarket, well, now all supermarkets have organic sections, as we know. Walmart has an organic
Even
section.
Walmart, yep.
That's another topic for another day. but I think that people are a lot of people who have kids and soccer games to go to and, everything else under the sun are just going to the market and buying everything there. And they don't have access to this. I sometimes see arugula, for instance, in the supermarket, and even under the little rain dance.
Right, the spray.
The spray. Right. It looks pretty sad. It came in a long time ago, right. And I'm not buying it.
Not flying off the shelves necessarily, yeah, at that supermarket. David Camp, how wide, how deep? I mean, we all know it's out there. We've seen it in the most unlikely places, even Walmart organics now. But do we have the time to pick it up and do it? How often are we partaking of this grand evolution?
Well, the caveat I always use is that, Tom, if we care to, we can eat better, healthier, more flavorfully than any Americans before us. And that's the caveat, if we care to. It's out there now. This better stuff is out there. But yes, as Cheryl was saying, there are a lot of people who aren't accessing the stuff. That said, I don't think the supermarkets are so bad. And I think you are seeing them gradually getting wise, getting hip to the fact that, oh my God, there's a greater expectation of better food. We'd better move. We better change our product profiles. We'd better tear up our produce sections. Because I can remember even worse produce sections from when I was a kid, which is why my mom resorted to bird's eye frozen vegetables, just because the fresh stuff was too pathetic.
Right, we remember them well. Everything frozen right up and down the aisle. And now, a new day, well dawned. Confessions to make on this day in my house. I don't roll the turkey. I'm not as fashion forward as you all. It's pretty standard old stuff. The cornbread stuffing and the mashed potatoes and the green beans and lots of pies. But you're painting this fringe, and more than fringe, of gourmet and new wave all around us. David Camp, take us all the way back. This is Thanksgiving, after all. You trace America's sort of fundamental attitudes about food back to the very earliest years of settlers on this continent.
Yeah, in doing research, you read the writings of people like James Fenimore Cooper, who said America has such great bounty, wild game, all this stuff, but why aren't Americans eating it? America has long had a sort of weird, dysfunctional relationship with good eating, that on the one hand, a lot of the early European visitors talked about how people pitchforked down their meat and their carbohydrates and didn't eat all this great vegetable bounty that Americans had, yet at the same time, there was great food to be had. And we hear this rhetoric oftentimes in election season about, you know, he's a brie eating this or a sushi eating that, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
What's funny is that goes back to, you know, the earliest days of the Republic when Martin Van Buren was running against William Henry Harrison. Van Buren was the incumbent, the aristocrat, and the Harrison campaign critiqued him for having a French chef in the White House, like that was too elitist and out of touch, whereas Harrison was the gnarled old war hero who existed on hardtack and beef jerky. And sure enough, Harrison won. And sure enough, he died 32 days into office.
Ouch. Cheryl Julian, David Camp reminds us, Thomas Jefferson, of course, spent years in France, came back to the U.S., was horrified by the state of American food. Then he called his fellow Americans the grossest feeders of any civilized nation ever known, a culinary clueless people. And David Camp points further back than that to the Puritans themselves, a kind of a let's not have too much pleasure with our food.
You know that the centerpiece of their Thanksgiving was a cod. So we should.
Right.
So we're not that
Nothing
close to them, actually.
Right.
But I think that Boston actually is the home of home cooking. I think it began with Fanny Farmer in the 19th century, who ran the Boston Cooking School. And then I think the baton was handed several years later to Julia Child. And I think that this is a city where people actually stay home and eat and make food.
David Camp, this is a day, I mean, we're, you know, broadcasting nationally here, and you'll have people all over the country listening and cooking. But this is a day when all Americans think about those pilgrims and their funny hats and life way back then. Do you still see the stamp of that time and the simplicity, the sort of anti-gourmand feeling coming from those very, very early years?
Well, not only do I see the stamp, I see a re-embrace of it. I don't think it's anti-gourmand. I think it's a reclamation of what you might call real food, which is not processed food. you know, what Cheryl was talking about, these great Yankee cookery traditions, whether it's the Maine lobstering tradition or more of that, you know, that bird stuffed with stuffing or across the country, a Wisconsin fish fry, you know, or some more Caribbean inspired thing in South Florida. There are all these great native traditions, indigenous traditions that are being reclaimed. And I'm glad Cheryl mentioned Julia Child, because part of what she did was help reclaim that. I think somewhere in sort of in the mid-century of American life, 20th century, things got out of whack, and the food processing companies and the appliance makers were trying to put down the experience of being in the kitchen. Kitchen work was drudgery. The housewives wanted convenience foods and convenience appliances just to get it over with, to get out of the kitchen.
Right.
And what people like Julia Child and James Beard did was they stepped in and they said, hold on a second, cooking is great. Spending hours in the kitchen preparing a meal is one of the most fulfilling things you can do. And then that social aspect of the day culminating in this wonderful evening meal, that's great too. And they reclaimed that from, you know, a society that had run amok to a degree because of this convenience aspect.
You know, if only we had the time to do that all the time. It's the day of the year when I wrap on that apron for the whole day and could not enjoy it more. I mean,
right. What is more pleasurable?
The kids are there, the family's there, the foods are, and all the smells are kind of a once-a-year medley when you put it all together. It's not something you do every day. Just fantastic. I want to invite one more voice into our conversation. We're talking with David Camp, the author of The United States of Arugula, and Cheryl Julian, food editor at the Boston Globe. Joining us right now from Pocantico, New York, is Dan Barber. He's chef and co-owner of the Blue Hill Restaurant in New York City and Blue Hill at Stone Barns in Westchester County, New York. Dan Barber, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
This is right back at you. What's going to be on your Thanksgiving Day menu, Dan?
I'm a traditionalist, so we're going with turkey and sweet potatoes and Brussels sprouts and pumpkin pie and pecan pie.
And do you prove your chops by gussying them up with a fancy new recipe or by doing them, you know, doing it perfectly in the old-fashioned way?
I'm pretty secure with the old-fashioned way. I'm highly insecure, actually, but I don't reveal that by mixing and matching different things with Thanksgiving. I love the tradition of it. And just like you were saying, I love the tradition that's surrounded not just with the food but with the family and the gathering around the table, and I feel like it informs us about a kind of food tradition that we all want to enjoy and experience. So I'd rather stick to the basics and be around the family.
So if there's a day on the calendar that where the food route goes the deepest, it may be today. Dan, what about in your restaurants? David Camp and Cheryl Julian talking about how American taste and cuisine are changing. We'll look at what you cook there, but what about in the appetites and tastes and readiness of your customers when they come in? Have they changed?
I think they've changed because the consciousness has changed. From where I'm standing, you know, the interest seems to be much more in who's growing the food. What different varieties of food are being grown, how they're being grown, how they're getting to the dinner plate. Those are all questions that over the last 5 to 10 years have become prominent.
So this is the gestalt that goes to seasonal and locally grown, and where did this come from, and let me taste the land beneath it or imagine that I can.
That's right. It's a complicated gestalt.
Do your customers demand that? Are they asking you, where's this asparagus from? Or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the customers who are coming to Blue Hill are generally informed to the extent that they know that Blue Hill represents. So Blue Hill is actually a farm in the Berkshire. So talking about Thanksgiving, it's the iconic New England landscape that, you know, we represent. And so we are doing quite a bit of our sourcing from local producers, and we're also growing quite a bit of our own. So, yes. I mean, it might be a little bit of a skewed reality here, in the sense that people who are coming to Blue Hill in the city or Blue Hill in Pocantico Hills are looking for that experience and that connection. So it seems to me like there's a real revolution going on in terms of interest.
Let us get a sense of the food moment from your menu. I know your restaurant's closed today for Thanksgiving,
yeah.
But all month you've had all kinds of wonderful seasonal fare on the menu. Describe some of that for us.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the the time of year for root vegetables, we're sort of right in the middle of it. After a series of freezes in the Northeast, the vegetables that go into the ground and the roots excel after a freeze. You know, they convert their all their starchiness to sugars. In fact, I've just learned from a plant scientist that's in part because it's a reaction out of fear of death, and the vegetables don't want any of their water to freeze, because once that happens, any of their cells freeze, they die. So they convert starches to sugar to lower their body temperature. And that's true of parsnips, of carrots, of rutabagas, of celery root.
So what do you do with them? Are you having soups?
We generally roast most of them to bring out those sugars at this time of year. It depends on the time of year, but right now we're you know, after all of these freezes, we're roasting and caramelizing as much of those sugars as possible. And so we have things like squash, roasted squash soup on the menu. We have parsnip gratin. We have a celery root. A sort of braised and roasted celery root and fall fruits dish. And all over the menu are the fabulous meats from both that we're raising on Blue Hill Farm and on our farm at Pecanico Hills, which raises ducks and chickens and turkeys, tons of turkeys.
Maybe a few less today.
That's right.
Cheryl, what about your table, your oven, your countertop, this time of year, your seasonal favorites?
Well, my favorites are with season more like weekly favorites. You know, I tend to go with what's coming out of the ground, both at the farmer's market and at our own farm. So, turkeys have been a big part of our life here for the last 6 months even. And so the fact that we were able to see them grow from chicks to healthy fat birds was a real pleasure to be a part of and see them in a surrounding and in a lifestyle that they sort of excelled in being in.
Turkey lifestyle. We'll ponder that, but not too much today. Cheryl, Julian, what about your autumnal lineup of favorites these days, 2006?
Well, I love squashes. My favorite is delicata, which is long and oval and has green stripes, and buttercup, which is green and has a little top hat on it, and almost has a eggplant texture after you roast it. It's quite meaty. You know, the weather here in New England has changed dramatically from it almost happened when the light started going, the time change, mm-hmm. and it went from quite warm to cool. And when the weather cools like that, I think that we all crave something that's heartier and warmer, and that's where these fall vegetables come in, Brussels sprouts and cabbage and cauliflower.
I've been
making
in all
golden cauliflower soup the last couple of weeks.
It's golden color. That's actually the yellow cauliflower.
Yes, it's really pretty.
Why is it that color? I just noticed it the other day.
Well,
in a
store. Can add it. You know, they cross.
You just put food coloring in the roots. No,
they crossbreed all of these vegetables, and it's one of the few vegetables that actually keeps its color in the pot. So it's very pretty after
quite
you cook it.
Bright,
yes.
Sort of a blazing gold. David Camp, you've got this great phrase. You talk about your big three, Julia Child, you mentioned, and James Beard and Craig Claiborne, as pioneers who changed how food in America hopped the fence from the ghettos of home economics and snobby gourmandism to the expansive realm of popular culture. You mentioned Julia Child. What about James Beard and Craig Claiborne, how they kickstarted this?
Well, Beard was a guy who came from a real foodie family. He came from a wonderful family in Portland, Oregon. His mom ran a hotel. So he grew up at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, immersed in food. But it never occurred to him that it could be a career. I mean, for guys like Dan, who now have almost a measure of celebrity about them, it's just kind of a funny evolution.
Because of people
like you. Right. here, you're the pop star, Dan.
Yeah. You totally rock, Dan.
But Thank you, Dan.
I have eaten at Dan's restaurant, I say that sincerely, if a bit ironically.
But in James Beard's day, not clear how to make a career out of that.
Yeah, and so Beard moved to New York ostensibly to become an actor. He wanted to make it in the theater. And if anyone knows what Beard looks like, that was kind of a comical premise, because he's great big 6'4" fat guy, prematurely bald, funny looking. But he had such an infectious enthusiasm for cookery. And when the acting didn't pan out, he reluctantly, you know, in middle age, went into writing cookbooks, doing cooking demonstrations, working for a catering company. And lo and behold, he caught on. And I think the reason he caught on is because he rescued the idea of cooking and the idea of eating from this sort of polarized world where it was either wifely duty, home economics, or cookery was this very fancy, snobby thing for, you know, gourmets, holdovers from the Gilded Age of the 19th century. And he was the one who said, suburban people, middle-class people, we can enjoy cooking. And it can become a cornerstone of our cultural identity as much as our literature is or our films are. I mean, in Italy and France, that's taken for granted. What you eat is part of who you are. In America, we're still learning that that's true.
Dan Barber, do you look back, read back, even watch the old videos of these great stars? Did you grow up with Julia Child? Were you reading James Beard? Do you feel their liberation, struggle, pleasure behind your cooking?
I might be one generation further removed from them in that I was directly inspired by chefs who got their opportunities based on the James Beards of the world. But my grandmother was a big devotee of Julia Child, and so I used to sit while she was doing her yoga and listening to Julia Child. So I have that.
Yoga and Julia Child, that's a great combination.
Yeah, my grandmother was a great combination, too, as well. So.
Wow. Cheryl, are we bringing these greats home, or is this what we look for when we go to Dan Barber's restaurant? I mean, what percentage of this do you think is coming into our everyday lives?
Of this good cooking?
Yeah.
Well, I think that there are many, many people interested in good cooking and good food and doing it at home. And it's just a matter of taking the time. And what has evolved, I think, over the last decade is home cooking and restaurant cooking. And restaurant cooking isn't something that people do at home. Restaurant cooking Dan, I've been to your restaurant and I loved your food, and I was not in the kitchen, so I don't know how you cook. But it involves a great deal more skill and complicated techniques.
More
than,
spectacular, more complex.
Yes, and duck breasts and pheasant and things we may not have in our refrigerator.
And a better sourcing of ingredients, too.
Yes, yeah. And home cooking has evolved into something that is much simpler and heartier, stews and soups, and lots of people use a slow cooker, although I don't like them and I don't appreciate them because I think that they ruin the texture of food. That's how a lot of Americans eat home-cooked food now. They put it in at breakfast and take it out at 5 o'clock.
It's ready when you get home from work.
Yes, and it's made from scratch, which I think is the important thing. And as far as James Beard goes, I think one of his greatest legacies is the onion sandwich. And you take a sweet onion, like a Vidalia, oh so sweet, one of the big Texas onions, and put it between two pieces of crusty bread with mayonnaise and salt and pepper, and it's really extraordinary. And he sort of invented that.
Well, it may be that we'll try that tomorrow with a little turkey stuck in there as well.
It
sounds great.
It's a great legacy, but how many people have the guts to bring one to their workplace?
Yes, right.
Maybe your last day on the job.
Yeah.
We can't get away from Thanksgiving food just because it's the day right in front of us. And Cheryl, you and I were talking earlier about where our Thanksgiving recipes come from. It makes me think about where all of our recipes come from. But this is a day you asked, are they family recipes? And it left me thinking, well, yes, but in the most extended sense of the word. You've got Aunt Ruth and you've got, Grandma Helen and right on around the table, many generations, many strands of the family come together on this day. David Camp, when you think about where Americans reach for recipes today, the bookshelf has never been heavier or deeper. Is that where we go?
Not on Thanksgiving, I wouldn't say. I would say on Thanksgiving we do revert to more of the family stuff and even those spiral-bound junior league cookbooks. And one thing, by the way, just because I've written this book about how we became a gourmet nation, I'm not a snob. I still love that casserole that someone in my family makes. It's the puree of butternut squash, but it's got the little mini marshmallows on top.
Right, and don't
Dan's probably going to kill me for saying that, but, you know.
Don't forget the French's roasted onions and green beans.
Exactly, yeah. And someone makes that. But at the same time, you know, there's a little eclecticism. Like, what I'm going to bring to the table is just a very slight twist. I'm going to make those seasonal Brussels sprouts, which are very much of this season in the Northeast. But the one thing I do is I cut up a little bit of pancetta to flavor it, mm-hmm. you know, which is an Italian bacon, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's just, you know, one little modern twist you can throw in there just to make bring things a little up to date. Not even a matter of bring things up to date, just to make things taste good.
Dan Barber, how about you as a professional chef? This is kind of a test in the way of the evolutionary theory. Do you feel distance from a family tradition, or does it run through your cooking?
Distance. I mean, what I feel increasingly is the sort of responsibility. I don't mean to sound magisterial, but I do. I'll go on.
It's Thanksgiving.
I do feel the kind of weight of the kind of decisions that I'm making in choosing what I buy for Thanksgiving and what I buy for the restaurants in terms of where the food's coming from and how it's grown and whatnot. And my belief is that. Is that when we can inform either our families or our communities or our diners, in my case, more about how the food is being grown and more of the backstory about the food tends to taste better. So that my cooking, you know, while without being falsely modest, it's good cooking, but I think it raises to another level when people understand that there's a story and there's a continuity to the food that extends beyond just a recipe or a technique. And that's the kind of cooking I see for the future. If David Camp were to write another of these wonderful books 30 years from now, what would it look like? And I think a huge portion of the book will be the next step, will be about the consciousness of food and how we're growing it. And
so you're pivoting on the family theme and I want to be sure I understand, is it taste or is it ecological morality you're talking about? Is it flavor, or is it save the planet while you celebrate the harvest?
Well, save the planet seems too weighty, but there's a taste memory involved with the enjoyment of food, and that's why the food at Thanksgiving, I think, in part, is so delicious, because we have the experience that goes beyond just the flavor of the food and just beyond whether the turkey was perfectly cooked or whether the Brussels sprout leaves were a little raw. I mean, that stuff tends not to matter as much on the Thanksgiving table because you're with your family, because you have a memory of and a connection to a much larger sense of the holiday. So I think you could take that metaphor, if you will, and extend it beyond that to just sort of everyday eating, that the more we know about where our food's coming from, the better it is.
David?
And if I could amend Dan's statement, I think when we talk about, you know, food revolution or food evolution, it's not about becoming more fancy or complex or fusion-y or stuffing the turkey with Thai basil or anything like that. A lot of it is what you might call just reclamation of old traditions, that old idea of knowing where your food comes from instead of it coming from a factory farm. You know, it comes from Dan's farm, and you can see it come that farm-to-table idea going from just Dan's place, where it's still pretty unique, to becoming a widespread phenomenon. Yet at the same time, Tom, you mentioned the save the planet aspect. That, I think, we always have to be very careful about, because if you flog the moral virtue of anything too hard, it just turns people off. So first and foremost, Dan's farm-raised food, it gets across simply because it tastes better than the factory food.
Taste memory. I love this phrase, Cheryl Julian, and it takes me back to wondering whether the taste memory has more to do with family and childhood and the kind of Proustian memory that David Camp was talking about earlier, or Dan Barber's talking about a taste memory that goes across the empty quarter of maybe post-war cooking and right back to the earth itself. Which runs stronger for you?
Well, there's something happening at the Thanksgiving table that goes well beyond food and the family dishes and some of the back-of-the-box recipes, like David's puree with the marshmallows. Right. And that is everybody getting together.
Hey, don't knock the puree with marshmallows.
Okay. That is the family being together at the table. That is the most powerful moment when there's a blessing before the meal. Thanksgiving is one of the times when everybody sits down. There are some families that have to clear out the furniture and put a ping pong table in the living room with folding chairs. And we've lost that in our in our society. At least many people have. We don't do that every night the way I think we
every
probably
night.
All grew up.
No, I mean,
doing
I was
that.
Thinking in my house, there's no way we've lost it on Thanksgiving, but every day.
No, we've right. lost it every day.
What about soccer
and,
games? What about
yes,
you know,
exactly.
to move the ping pong table every day?
Yes, right. And I think that. I think that the lesson to be taken away from Thanksgiving is that we should sit down together and have this warm conversation and look around and see each other, and everyone is either in a good mood or on their best behavior, which you sometimes have to order the
Knock
kids
wood.
To do, and it's just quite a nice feeling. When that happens, and then there's good food.
Amen. No kidding. David Camp, in your big three, we haven't come to Craig Claiborne as kind of one of those who unleashed all that came after, born to a proper Southern family, just as it was experiencing a reversal of fortune. What's the thread you follow from Claiborne into the food habits you see today among Americans?
Well, two threads. One was, he invented what you might call the make-or-break starred restaurant review, meaning going to a restaurant, checking it out, saying, I give it 1 star, 2 stars, 3 stars. He invented that modern, almost spectator sport aspect of restaurant going. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean that in an insulting way. He energized the middle class, basically, to care about dining out. It used to really be for rich people, or it was just the greasy spoons in the taverns. And he was the one who really made it a more of a middle class pursuit that everyone could get into. And again, I think this is a win-win situation. This helps the restaurateurs. It also helps people get interested in food more. The other thing he did was he was very interested as a journalist in writing about home cooks. And he would find people, you know, reporting for the New York Times, he would find Chinese home cooks, Italian-American home cooks, and he would ask them for their recipes and write-up columns. So even if you weren't of those ethnic backgrounds, it used to be much more walled off by ethnicity. I mean, home cookery was.
Sure. And it was a big deal to go out to even an Italian restaurant. I can remember when that was something special. I mean, it's still special, but then it was like odd, different, exotic.
Total exotica to have Italian food. I mean, this time of year, we start watching the movie It's a Wonderful Life, and there's that wonderful scene by Frank Capra, the director, who is himself Italian-American. He has evil Mr. Potter, played by Lionel Barrymore, chiding George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart, for giving bank loans to the Italian immigrants who ran the bars and the restaurants. He says, you're frittering away your life playing nursemaid to a bunch of garlic eaters.
Oh, jeez.
Garlic.
We're all garlic, eaters now.
Even garlic was considered, our refined palates can't handle garlic. Yeah. That's just for the Italian immigrants.
Yeah.
And again, that shows how far we've come.
Dan Barber, the Craig Claiborne story and the critic as arbiter brings me back to you as the restaurateur and chef. How do you judge yourself? Are you breathlessly waiting for that secret visit, or is it by a few favored customers whose response you like, or is it
your two other guests on the line sneaked in under the radar? So obviously, I'm not very good at spotting these.
Well, we're not critics, Dan. We're the nice
we're
people.
We're there to champion you.
But how do you judge when you've hit a home run or not as a restaurateur, as a chef?
How do I judge it?
Yeah.
Well, boy, I don't feel like I hit many home runs. I hit a triple now and again. The home runs are hard to come by.
You must have a yardstick, a measure. I mean, is it somebody on your wait staff who's your, you know, like royal taster, or is it your a significant other or a particular customer whose eyebrows you follow?
How? I feel like there are two sides of the home run analogy, and one side of it is the diner that comes in and begins to ask questions. The restaurant at Stone Barns is sitting literally in the middle of a farm, so you're looking out as you're eating your tomato salad. You're looking out on a field of growing tomatoes. So it's the diners that come in and enjoy the tomato salad on what this other level, you know, that want to ask about how the tomatoes were grown and want to ask about the different varieties and da da da. And so when we get diners to have the taste of that salad or whatever they're eating and to start asking questions and become involved and informed and curious, I feel a real success. I feel like I'm a successful chef and that we're speaking more than just about the food. And then on the opposite end, I feel like I'm a success when, the hedge fund manager comes in and wants a tomato salad and a steak and a glass of Chardonnay and wants to go home, but loves the experience and, tells his friends and comes back back often just for that kind of experience. So I feel like, you know, there's a lot of ways to I don't know, there are a lot of points of entry into a successful restaurant and a successful dining experience. And so I'd like to cover all the bases, as it were. And so my hope is that no matter what your desire is, and no matter what your level of sophistication and interest in food is, that you can come to either of my restaurants and just have a good meal.
Cheryl, what about at home? How do you see home cooks assessing, you know, when it's fantastic, when they're off the mark? Are they watching Sister Sue's face or holding themselves up against Mario Bartali, you know, on the television standard, or the latest restaurant, or something else entirely? What's the measure?
I think home cooks are just as hard on themselves as Dan is on himself. Because we know he runs an extraordinary, two extraordinary restaurants. Home cooks are forever apologizing.
Right.
We all learned from Julia never to apologize. I was a cooking student.
I'd like to apologize to my whole family right now.
Okay.
On the hook, duly noted.
When I was a cooking student at the Cordon Bleu in London, they used to say, if the cake doesn't come out, bung it into a bowl, add some whipped cream, and call it a pud. So
boom.
I think we should all do a little bit
good
more
advice
of that.
On Thanksgiving Day, yes, juggling everything.
Right.
Well, I want to ask about something we've barely touched on, but you talked earlier, Cheryl, about the kind of simplicity around the table and sharing. All that makes me think of bread, the sort of simple, or what we thought of as the simple part of the meal and the sharing part of the meal. David Camp, do you get into bread? I'm trying to remember if you really touch on it. Where we've gone with the baked side of American cuisine, the breads.
Well, I touch upon it in the book. In terms of home baking, it really, I think it reached its apex in the 70s when the sort of crunchy granola era, the back to nature era, with places like the Moosewood cookbook, which was sort of a vegetarian Bible, and the Tassajara bread book, which came out of the Buddhist Zen Center in San Francisco. I think that in this kind of hurried restaurant going takeout age, home bread baking is a bit on the wane, although I think it's a wonderful thing, and I think
not
it's ripe for a comeback.
Yes, those
carbohydrates. That's another thing. That's actually what exasperates me, is the way we lurch from one food hysteria to another, and the demonization of so-called carbs, which is just so misbegotten. I think that damaged bread for a while, but I think that that's waning, and I'm hoping that we're going to enter a new heyday for bread.
I mean, there's a time to let that go, for heaven's sake. Thanksgiving Day, I know, when the couple of loaves of bread come out of the oven, there's an awful lot of cheating in my house. The butter comes out and the hot bread's there, and suddenly everybody's around for an early hit.
Pretty high-carb day, Thanksgiving. It's not exactly a balanced meal. It's meant to stick to your bones.
What do you see happening with breads, Cheryl?
I see people going to all these artisanal bakeries.
Home, but to the expert baker.
Yes, yes. I made focaccia last weekend, and the way the live yeast felt in the dough under my hands, I just thought, what an extraordinary experience. I haven't made bread since the Sahara days. But the artisanal bakeries are really doing extraordinary things. And you can buy pastries in probably most major cities in this country the way that they're made in France. And they're quite beautiful, and we're supporting our local people in another way. They're not farmers, but they're merchants. And I think that fewer and fewer people are baking. But there is a hardcore group of bakers who will never give it up.
Well, let the bread rise today. Chef Dan, at the restaurant, what is it, all breads full of cranberries and nuts in your realm? Or
I don't love
stuff?
Fruit breads, I have to say. It's much more plain at both restaurants, with crusty baguettes and rolls and big artisanal breads. Well, we finish some breads in the ovens here, but we don't make our own breads because I think the quality of what you can buy from real expert bakers is too high to ignore. And so we tend to buy from some local bakeries up in Westchester and some great old New York bakeries in New York. and it does more than just fill your stomach. It's a real experience to eat bread that's well made and easy to come by.
Well, high hats off to the great bakers everywhere, but today's a day we're happy to get our fingers in the dough, smell all the great aromas coming out of the kitchen, and appreciate the evolution that David Camp is writing about. At our website, by the way, a bunch of good recipes, rosemary biscuits with smoked turkey and cranberry relish from Cheryl Julian and more. I want to thank all of my guests on this Thanksgiving Day, Cheryl Julian, food editor for the Boston Globe, co-author of The Way We Cook. Cheryl, thanks so much for being
here.
Thank
you. My pleasure.
Dan Barber, chef and co-owner of the Blue Hill Restaurant. Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And David Camp, author of The United States of Arugula. David, thank you so much. Happy Thanksgiving.
And same to you. Happy Thanksgiving.
To everybody, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.